Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group and also co-founder of AEG Systems. And today's guest is someone I just absolutely adore in the education field. Now, I want to bring and Dr. Fernandez Rigg, I got to highlight this. So I attended this year's TAPSES conference, and that was in February. And the night before the actual conference started, shout out to TAPSES Texas. Love that group. Talas, that Rick is a part of, love that group as well. Dr. Thomas, the great leadership over there. But Rick and I, we were in Dallas, and we were having dinner. And Rick, and it was a bunch of us, and Rick, I mean, just the knowledge that he was just unpacking, and specifically how we were talking about the use of data, how we should use data in education, specifically when we think about this 22nd century lens, and then bringing that in. But what caught my attention was when Rick stated, and this was unprovoked on my end, is that every school system needs a data scientist. And I turned and looked at Rick. I'm like, Rick, I've been saying that for like 10 years, and you're like the only other person in the world that has said that. And then we probably geeked out for like 4 straight hours there. And that was, you know, I'd met Rick before, but that was my really true introduction to Dr. Rick Fernandez. And we have just been keeping in touch ever since. And this is long overdue. Dr. Fernandez is a former superintendent, has been through the trajectory in education, every single type of leadership role. And now he is the chief growth officer for Bluekit Software. And so you can see now he's one of the, I like to say, one of the outliers in education that is challenging standard research, challenging standard theoretical logic models, theoretical frameworks, and bringing that in with advanced analytics and artificial intelligence. And I tell you, I've been looking forward to recording this episode because, again, not only selfishly am I bringing Rick on VFE, but also get to unpack more of the intellectual property of Dr. Rick Fernandez. So without any further ado, I would love to introduce Dr. Rick Fernandez down in the great state of Texas. Now, Doc, what do they say? Everything they do in Texas is a little bit bigger. So I know that this episode is going to be a little bit bigger for our audience today. So thank you for joining us, Dr. Fernandez.
Yeah, no, Michael, thank you for having me. And yes, everything is a little bit bigger, and we do believe we are our own country down here. So, you know, we just see Texas as its own unique place, and I love everything about it. And great to be here and talk a little shop with you. And I know you've been doing some great work and with some districts in Texas. So hopefully we can touch on that a little bit, because help is needed really everywhere around the country in terms of our public education system.
I concur with you, Dr. Fernandez. And I'll tell you this, you know, to my audience, please follow Dr. Rick Fernandez on LinkedIn, because it is not a highlight reel, as I like to say, sometimes LinkedIn could be, but Dr. Fernandez provides some very specific targeted metrics pertaining to Texas public education, his breakdown of what districts look like as they're starting to shift to this choice model in Texas as well. Looking at the whole education system in totality in Texas. So it's not just, you know, like I said, the highlight reel within LinkedIn, but he brings very deliberate and informative information regarding education and the paradox that we're experiencing today. But again, Dr. Fernandez, I can't wait to touch upon that. But as a nationally recognized educational leader, everybody, Rick, it doesn't matter where you're at. You could be in Alaska. You'd be like, you know, Dr. Rick Fernandez. Yeah, I worked with him.
I don't know about Alaska. It's a little cold up there, but I'll take it.
But Rick, man, I'm telling you, anywhere I go, Dr. Rick Fernandez, and no, Rick, I'm like, man, what? Like, Rick, you know, everybody, man. I don't know who's worse, you or Jacob. But as a recognized national education leader, former superintendent of schools, and now deeply immersed in this edtech vertical ecosystem, for individuals that don't know who you are and the work and the legacy work that you have contributed in education, what song describes your leadership signature in education today?
What song? That's a tough one. Maybe like the Rolling Stones is probably what I think about in terms of there's so many variables, and the variables have changed so rapidly within the last, we'll take the COVID era. So during COVID and then after the fact, and all of the hits that Public Ed is taking, and some, you know, self-inflicted, right? There's a lot of our pain that has been self-inflicted, and we all are aware that systems don't move very rapidly. And so, you know, I like to think of it as like, maybe AC/DC, like Back in Black, right? We got to get some of our juice back and quit hanging our heads and start to break down why we have the barriers, but what are the root causes? And the only way to really look at that when you have so many different variables is you got to have the correct data systems, and you have to have all of the data, not piecemeal. Because you can't do anything with piecemeal data. And it's why I believe we get the trends of a little bit of progress, and then we flatline, and then we'll dip, and then we get a little bit more progress. And then, so there's not a real trajectory of steady growth that I've been able to see really across the country. And we can fix that. We truly can fix that. We have the tools now that enable us to get a better perspective on what we need to do, how we need to do it, and where our resources need to be delivered.
I love Dr. Fernandez, how you stated, right? You talked about the Rolling Stones, right? And the complexity and the reactivity of change within the variables of the operating model. Very intentional, as you stated that, right? Specifically during that time in COVID, that's why I created that time ecology or ecological model that shows BC stage before COVID, during COVID, which was an immediate disruption that we had to respond to. And now 7 years into the AC stage of education, which I'm calling AC 2035, which we know that artificial intelligence, digital reimagination is going to be standardized within the operating model by that time, 2035. But you talked about this, right? Root causes versus symptoms. And in order for us, and I like the residual of how you connected that, in order for us to really get to the level of understanding the complexities within that are embedded within these variables, you have to do RCAs, root cause analysis. But the alignment, Dr. Fernandez, and this is what we talked about in Dallas, is that you have to have the data infrastructure and the architecture in order to do that real-time analysis, to continuously to ask those essential questions around what are some of those systemic root causes that we're trying to dismantle. Right now, we talked about it, Dr. Fernandez, we're just only addressing symptoms, and we're just putting Band-Aids that needs over a wound that needs stitches, right, with that. But we're going to go much more deeper into that with regards to the necessary data systems and architecture to be able to now make those systemic changes so that now it's sustained, because we're addressing the root cause. But I want you, Dr. Fernandez, to put your superintendent executive leadership hat back on, right? And when you think about this leadership work in your role as a district leader or district leaders currently, how did you design and transform standard models, right? Because knowing your work intimately, Dr. Fernandez, you were a true systems disruptor in the BC stage of education, right? I always say that you and I, Dr. Fernandez, we didn't become cool until the DC stage of education. And now everybody's like, hey, Dr. Fernandez, Dr. Connor in the AC stage. But in the BC stage, we were anomalies, right? We were outliers and people thought we were crazy. But how did you sustain and transform standard models to be future-driven and future-ready for what I'm calling the AC 2035 economy? And then two, to couple that, how did you shift mindsets to focus on global readiness for students in lieu of this, what I like to say, linear emphasis on accountability metrics?
You know, that's a great question. And I don't typically, you know, toot my horn or tout anything, but I do think one of the skill sets that I have is kind of looking around the corners and predicting, seeing some things that are typically not common knowledge or not something that educators typically focus on, and taking that piece of information, that data, and then applying that to what is coming for the system. And it all starts with some of the things that are really common sense, but have been taboo. And I'll give you a prime example, right? So, you know, districts all across the world have tried to figure out, how do we improve student outcomes? Is it a curriculum thing? Is it a technology thing? Is it a class size thing? And the reality of it is if you look at sports, if you look at any fine arts, if you look at any skill set that you're trying to achieve, it's time and practice and coaching and feedback. And it is the regularity and the cadence of that has to be at a very high level. And the only way to do that is being in those classrooms. And because you would not expect anybody that's coaching your son, they go to practice and you watch practice for a week, and throughout the week, the coach says nothing to the team, doesn't give any type of feedback, no skill work, nothing. And then the game's on Saturday, and we expect the kids to be able to play, a game of basketball and be successful at it. Like, that just doesn't happen. But we don't really apply that understanding into the classroom because it's uncomfortable, or because, well, you got to give teachers autonomy. Yes, teachers can have autonomy, but we do have to have a collective agreement that everybody is responsible for improving continuously, right? Because with all of the variables that we have, if you don't do that, if you don't have the mindset of this is just kind of the culture that we have to have in order to be successful, then you don't improve, because everything else could be right. Curriculum could be perfect. The tech could be the best technology. Your PLC work could be great, whatever. But if you're not seeing instruction in practice and not helping people, improve, but you as either an evaluator, a coach, mentor, whatever, you're not improving your craft alongside that, how do people grow? Right? Because you don't know, you're not seeing it. You got to see it through both lenses so that there's like a system of continuous improvement. So that's not some type of, equation that we had to figure out. It's just, it's right in front of us. And yet we don't really address that like we should until now, when things are the worst and kids are struggling so bad and parents are so upset and the state's going to come in and take over your district. Now, all of a sudden, there's the urgency for that. And just those little shifts of like, what's the baseline things that we could do immediately? So building a standard of, if we have a continuous improvement model that we adhere to and that's sacred and everything is built around that, then that's a starting point, right? And now we've got that in place. We've got that culture. And now we have the ability with all the technology, we've got the ability to see all the data sets in real time and adapt in real time. Just like you would call an audible in a football game, now we can start calling audibles. Teachers can call audibles in the classroom. And if they get up to the line and they don't like what they see, that's not working out, there's something going to go wrong, hey, in real time, let's pivot. And we've really never had that ability to do that. So anybody that's ever said that there's been personalized learning going on, I would take issue with that, because we haven't had the capability to ever do that in the moment. We've tried, but there just wasn't the systems to do that. And so the continuous improvement alongside that data and that using that data in real time and just getting into the habit of, man, I've got it at my fingertips and I'm going to apply that to the maximum extent I can. Every single class, every period, every day, I think we'll see some miraculous transformation, or not miraculous, but some transformation that we haven't ever experienced in public yet.
Yeah. And Dr. Fernandez, going back to your response at the outset, when you stated that you looked at your system very differently and you were predicting, to my audience, the reason why I love Dr. Fernandez, in the BC stage of education was underscoring predictive analytics in a real-time manner to be able to create this adaptive model with the variables that he's talking about in education. Again, this is where, I know Rick's work, when he was a superintendent, and I was like, wow, the way that he's designing his system, it was all underscored with predictive analytics as well as descriptive analytics as well, kind of a combination, but it was such an outlier. But I loved how you talked about, and you used the football analogy, the coach analogy, time, practice, and feedback. But I want to ask a sub-question, Dr. Fernandez, for clarity level set with my audience, because I think these are two very foundational phrases that you highlighted within your response. One, can you define for level setting purposes for my audience, what a system of continuous improvement look like? And then two, I want you to couple that by defining what is a continuous improvement model. And Dr. Fernandez, the reason I want you to do that is because it is so important. I call it an educational imperative now that we create that system or the systems of continuous improvement, and then defining your continuous improvement model and have this embedded layer of your strategic operating plan, your school improvement plan, your instructional framework that works in reciprocity with your continuous improvement model. But I want my audience to really unpack your IP with regards to that.
I mean, I've always seen continuous improvement is synonymous with your culture. It's what we do, the work that we do every single day, right? And so how we go about the work and how we agree to improve. And that model in practice has to be very specific and spelled out. And the continuous improvement is a byproduct of the culture that we have, the work that we do, and all of the systems built around to facilitate that work. And I'll give you an example, right? So when you have administrators that are trying to help teachers improve their instructional practice, but the whirlwind of a day can come in and you have an upset parent, or you have a situation with a student, or you have a board member situation, or there's a fire drill. All of those things are going to always be present. But if you build your system where all of your administrative assistants know that here is the only reason that you interrupt me when I'm in instructional rounds with teachers, right? And one of the other administrators takes over my grade level or my alpha split or whatever it is. And you design everything around what you hold dear. And if you don't do that, and if everybody doesn't know from your administrative assistants to all of your teachers, they know you're in classes. And all of that is transparent, right? So the schedules, my calendar, they can see where I am every single day, because that level not only gives them line of sight into, hey, we're going to improve. Like, you're going to be coached. I'm going to be coached. That is how we do business. So the continuous improvement is just, it needs to be the culture that you have, and how you do the work and what you hold sacred in terms of student outcomes and in terms of your staff outcomes, because we're always looking at the student outcomes. That's great, but your staff has to grow and they have to understand that that's a part of the role. But when they do grow, man, your retention goes up. They get better. They can see it. They can feel it. They feel like a team of like, man, we're all working, getting better. We're all doing this early morning workout together, right? Like when you got a buddy that goes to the gym with you, there's accountability, and you help and support each other. And it's a feeling of collective, like, hey, we're collectively accountable. And when somebody's not pulling their weight, everybody has to look over there and say, hey, you got to get together. So I really do believe it is the ability to come together and whatever there is, your sacred, whatever you're holding sacred, putting in the system that's driving towards that goal. And everything, the money, your board, your system that you have at your campuses, what you talk about in your meetings, all of that comes first, right? All of that comes first, and everything else has to be done kind of in an ancillary manner, meaning we'll do these things, absolutely run the district, have the business of the district, but 80% of our time are about this one thing, right? Getting better, instructional practice. And I don't know how else to move schools other than just really getting good at helping each other improve.
Yeah. Great answer, Dr. Fernandez. One of my key takeaways, right, or resonating themes you stated, is about culture, right? And I think that we look at, or sometimes we look at, or even misconstrue continuous improvement and even developing that model where it acts in this analogous sense, where you're saying that it's synonymous. It has to be synonymous, embedded in the culture. But Rick, and I alluded to it earlier, at our dinner with the conversation where we were talking about, you know, districts or learning organizations moving to incorporating data science, data scientists, also looking at how we can create data infrastructure and architecture within our learning organizations, where now we're using real-time metrics so that we're agile and adaptive. But when you think about this, right, those are outlier practices. I always like to say that, Rick, you know, education, because of the construct and how we design our data architecture and how we design our infrastructures, it only allows exactitude analyses. We only can get to that symptom level where we have to create architecture where it facilitates inexactitude analyses, where now we're looking at academic metrics and operational metrics to define how we move the system forward, or how we're looking at outlier data together, concatenate it. I apologize, Dr. Fernandez, for using that big word, but that's the only way to describe how we move to this level of getting to the root cause. But it's not standardized. How do we make this outlier practice of using data standardized so we can sustain the systems that we want to create for continuous improvement?
Well, I think there has to be some awareness of what are the data sets that matter and what are the data sets that are blind spots and always have been blind spots. And I think you have to do that by asking some of the tough questions and without doing it kind of in a tacky way, call out some of those things with colleagues. And I'll give you a prime example. So if you were to ask, any superintendent around the country or ask their, hey, talk to your principals, who is your absolute best teacher on your campus, right? They'll tell you a name, but when you boil it down as to, okay, why did you believe that? What are the facts, the data sets that tell you that? You're going to get a wide variety of answers, right? Maybe it's, accountability test state testing. Maybe it's ACT, SAT. Maybe it's, they're above, grade level with their Lexile, their literacy. Who knows? But dialing in as to why students improve, and is it a result of the teacher? Is it a result of a system? How do you really dial in on that? So first you got to figure out why the best are the best. And is there a common denominator there? I would argue that there are several common denominators with that, but nobody's really looking at it in a holistic manner to say, okay, if we put this teacher in a different setting, in a different grade level, what have you, they are still going to perform at a very high level. And again, I'll go back to the sports analogy. Some people on certain teams, they look like a superstar, right? They've got all the points, but they're not winning. The team isn't winning. It's dysfunctional. This person's a standout, and then you put them in a different setting and they can't perform or they underperform. So truly, really dialing in is like, do you know who your best teachers are and why they are the best? What are the things that they do that others aren't doing, right? Is it on the relationship side, the instructional side? Is it the system that they have where kids are so dialed in? It's like, well, I know if I go to Miss Smith's classes, I got to do this, this, and this, and it's the rhythm of it. Trying to figure out what that is and then holding that as a standard of these are the things that we want all teachers to do. And I don't know that if you ask that question, there would be a lot of people that could tell you that with any degree of specificity. So I think that's one piece of it is not, we don't really know why our best are our best, or we will say somebody's the best, but when you really dial into the data, does that bear out? Right? Are we on track with that? Or are they perceived the best because of longevity or the kids love them or they're great employees, right? We've all had great employees, but might not necessarily be the best at the practice, at the instructional practice that they're delivering to students. So I think we've got to figure out what that is. And then on the other side of like, we spend so much time with student attendance, right? But how big of an impact is teacher attendance on those same students? That never goes into the equation.
Absolutely. 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 That's so important. Dr. Fernandez, you're giving me agita right now, right? Because, and please continue, but I just wanted to state this, that, you know, when I was doing some modeling exercises when I was a superintendent, and I always used to bring in teacher attendance data within the academic data and modeling that and looking for specific correlations, people don't realize that teacher attendance impacts achievement. And you can even break it down by the months of, okay, if you see an average of X, you can see a steady decline in your students for that month. But then all of a sudden, when teacher attendance is near perfect, now you see this trajectory of going up. Linear regressions, my friend. But I want to bring this up to you, because as you were talking about this best teacher analogy, and I want to ask you this, Dr. Fernandez, and I'm bringing sports into this, okay? The whole Jaylen Brown issue. Cleveland Cavaliers coach, when you look at Jaylen Brown analytically, you wouldn't want to pick him up on your team. And I'm talking about diverse measures that, you know, the normal person wouldn't even take into consideration, you know, with regards to, you know, being on the court, all these other measures that proves that Jaylen Brown actually doesn't, how can I say this? You could get more wins with Jaylen Brown off the court, but to the eye, 28, averaging 28 points, 7 rebounds, finals MVP, champion, carried his team, 6th in the NBA MVP voting, but yet analytics describe him as no more than the 4th and 5th best player on the team, which is true. The Cleveland Cavaliers coach is down 0-3 against the Knicks, and then he's saying analytically we're beating the Knicks 3-0. In reality, he's right. From an analytics standpoint, they were better than us in every category, but we wound up sweeping the Cavs. Let's think about that from a teacher. A teacher's getting the data, but analytically, if you break it down, is not it could improve exponentially. Help me with that dichotomy, right? Because we're going to see more of we're seeing it in sports now. Natural progression is going to be in education, Rick. How do we deal with that?
Yep. And so that's a great parallel there. I would tell you that if I were looking to go find the best of the best in any data, anywhere, one of the places I would look would be sports, because not only do they have some of the top minds, but there's so much money at stake. So there is a huge urgency to get things right. And so they look at everything kind of interwoven to see, all right, which player at which price best complements the rest of the players, right? So they're looking, like I believe we should be looking at education. They're not leaving anything to chance. They're putting it all together to say, this is where we need to go. You bring up the Spurs. There's one thing that really can't be calculated with just the raw numbers, and that is the coaching and an experience component of, in this moment, when we can't have A, B, or C happen, have our players been taught well enough? Are we prepared for a moment that is coming that we have not seen before, right? So the adaptability and the preparation for something that hasn't happened, if that makes sense. Because all of those guys on the Spurs were new to that moment, including the coach. And the analysis is absolutely correct. Like, they beat the Knicks for almost 80, 90% of the entire series, right? But it's during that crunch time where things get tight and pressure ramps up, and there's not, they clearly had not discussed it, worked through it, and adapted when they needed to, because none of them had been in that moment. So seeing a moment and coaching for a moment, even though it has not been experienced, it's hard. It's a hard thing to do because people are, why are we doing this? We don't need to, you're trying to prepare us for something that may not happen. So that forecasting ability and analytics is hugely, hugely needed in terms of education, because for the most part, we can, to some degree of certainty, predict if something goes wrong, these are probably the things that will go wrong and disrupt our day, disrupt our district, disrupt our system, right? So we do get enough of an inkling of, we need to be able to account for these things, even if we've never experienced it, vouchers, right? Even if we never experienced it, there's enough data and information that other people have that we can say, should this come at a federal level, which I believe it will, how would that impact us? But you gotta have those conversations before the event happens. You gotta coach it. You gotta prepare before it happens. Before you get in the fourth quarter with a bunch of rookies and guys that haven't been to the NBA championship, if that's the first time they're seeing it, then they're just reacting however they would normally react. Whether it's less urgency, whether it's, you know, not doing the right thing, not adapting or pressing too much, and it's kind of what San Antonio did. Like, you lose by 30, you know, you had to lose a 30-point lead. All you had to do was just not shoot as many threes the second half, which is not a big adaptation. It's like, all right, guys, like, look, let's dribble the ball a little bit more, take some time off the clock before we shoot.
As a Knicks fan, Rick, I didn't complain.
Oh no. No. And I love both teams. I thought that both teams played well, but you could see, you know, almost feel the lack of, we don't know what to do in this moment. And so we revert to what we believe is the right thing, but it in turn, it's not the right thing. And so it gives a chance for somebody to come in. So like vouchers, right? Now it's a whole lot of competition. And if we don't accept that there's now competition where we've never had any, and we wait till it's like live and on the ground, it's kind of what we're experiencing here in Texas, is like, everybody's like, oh no, I didn't realize I was going to lose this many kids to private school vouchers. Well, yeah, kind of, you should have been able to see the writings on the wall, and we just ignore it to some degree, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And Rick, I love that, as you stated that, because I was speaking to a few people and they were like, you know, the Spurs, you know, should have won the series. They're a better team. And, you know, as a Knicks fan, I wouldn't acknowledge that. Right. But I said, what we have to take into a fact, we have to take into a factor that we haven't highlighted this. And this was before the series. I was like, three of your top players are 3 years or less in the NBA that average 21 years and younger. I was like, you have a team that has multiple people that played in the Eastern Conference Finals and played in some very, very big games. I was like, that is going to be a factor for this series. And you're right, it was. But I loved how you analyzed the decision tree analysis forecasting. But as you stated at the outset, was the question, what are the data sets that matter? I want to move into the whole voucher system in Texas, because you've been doing a lot of great analysis, providing a lot of high level implications on how it can hurt districts or help districts, or, you know, however you want to take it from that stance. But, you know, when you think about this from a national broader sense, the implications that, you know, can lead to this voucher system across the country, Texas and Florida are the two states that people are looking at. Now, Rick, this was another segment of our, you know, dinner meetup that we had. And, you know, and would I say this, it presents a level of contention, you know, specifically to public school educators. I said that, you know, I have no issue with a market-based reform, market-based or innovation-based competition. I have no issues with that. You know, in any other industry, there's that level of competition. Rick, if you open up an ice cream parlor right across the street from my ice cream parlor, guess what? I got to change my products or enhance my products so that the customer, the client, can come to me in lieu of your ice cream parlor. I don't see anything wrong with that when we're talking about a kid's education, where that now there's that level of market-based competition, innovation-based competition, so that for the client, the student, the most important customer, who is our families and our students. So given the fiscal implications that you have highlighted across the country pertaining to districts in Texas, what are the operational pivots needed in this era of education choice?
I mean, first and foremost is that districts have to wake up and realize, like, we are in the sales game, right? We have clients, and our clients have options, and a lot more options than they've ever had. And so to remain competitive, if we don't understand what our clients are seeking and how to deliver whatever it is that they're seeking in a timely enough manner, then our system will cease to exist, right? So that has to be kind of the foremost, like, we have to do things differently, and we have to be able to compete, and all of the things that we have been holding on to for whatever reason, whether it's legacy programming, whether it's, you know, certain systems that don't necessarily allow for a lot of flexibility within scheduling. Like, if we hold that, if we go down that hill, you will continue to hemorrhage students and families for that matter. So the first thing is just the acknowledgement is like, we can't do this any longer like this. And then the other thing is like, what, answer this one question. What does our district provide that no other district around us, no competition, whether it be my public school colleague down the street or the charters around me, the privates around me, what can we offer that they cannot offer? And if we can't answer that question, we need to start building something and to have some differentiation in a very strategic manner about what we offer students, right? And but my frustration with kind of the lack of that thinking is there's never been a better time to offer those things, because now we've got a lot of technological advances that can really help our programming in our classes and our dual credit, like, really blossom. You've got industry wanting to pour into education more so than it ever has. And their industry is telling us, here are the jobs, here was what, you know, what's coming and what's kind of going away. Here's what the struggle is going to be if your kids don't have these skills or that skills. I mean, industry has pretty much said, like, we're not too concerned with your pedigree, with your college pedigree. We're more concerned with, I need this. Can you do this? And can you do it at a high level consistently? And if you can do that, I've got quite a bit of money for you. And again, going back to the sports analogies, like, some of these entry-level positions, particularly in the AI field, are paying like rookie salaries if you were looking at football or basketball or MLB. And that's no joke. Big time dollars, right? And it's going to be the age of entrepreneurship and innovation, and that's going to be at an individual level. So if I were a district, I would be looking at programming. I would be looking at flexibility and scheduling. I would be looking at my industry partners, like, bringing them into a degree that we never have. I would be making sure that my parents, and through all the means that we have available to us, are very aware of the things we're doing to make sure your kids, should they attend my district, are going to have something unique that you can't get anywhere else. And, oh, by the way, our instruction is going to be excellent too, but we're going to change because we see what the future's, that future's coming, right? So we think of the four core, right? If you really look at what's coming, we probably should be teaching certain technical entrepreneurship skills as core. I would even argue AI would needs to be a part of a kind of a core language, if you will, right? Not seen as a program or a CTE or an enhancement. It needs to be a part of, this is, you can't really do anything without this. And your reading, your math, all of those things are taught through the lens of what do we need to be able to do? What are the skills that are needed? What type of critical thinking? how do I become an entrepreneurial thinker? Because I'm going to have to be my job path is not going to be one company for 25 years and retire, or 30 years and retire. It's going to be 20 different jobs with 20 different people, some part-time, some full-time, some running my own thing, some having to pivot because something has changed so rapidly. And I've got to continuously to innovate for my own behalf, right? And that's all problem-solving skills. That's all that is problem-solving skills. And there's no reason we couldn't like have a absolutely fantastic literacy component that helps kids read and learn and problem solve, or mathematical components with how we do things. And so I think operationally, we really need to look, it's like, what do you want your kids to be able to do? And all parents usually say, like, I want them to do better than me. I want them to be able to, you know, make a great living, have a great life, have the type of life that they dream about. Okay, if that's what you want, and here's what the workforce is saying is needed and what's valuable, and it's only going to accelerate, then why are we doing this? You know, and we got to start with those tough questions. And then, you know, we can't spend 2 years to figure that out. Like, I know you do a lot of work. You do a lot of work with strategic planning, and we're of the same mind. It's like, look, at the very least, I need to be here every year we got to update this thing, because it's a continuous improvement plan. It's to tweak. It will forever be tweaked, right?
Absolutely. Rick, I love you, brother. I love you. Thank you. I just love, to my audience, I selfishly just text Rick and say, Rick, can we meet? And Rick will be like, and Rick has never said no, because 9 times out of 10, we add the business element of it. But as they say, iron sharpens iron. I'm like, all right, I need my fix. So I'm like, Rick, can we meet? And Rick will be like, yeah, sure. And then we're like 50 minutes into it, and we're just geeking out like, oh, okay, Rick, this is why we meet. But I loved it.
I got to bring my thesaurus when I meet with you, there, right? Because you always drop some stuff like, man, I feel like I read all the time. I was like, I ain't never heard of that word. And I got to check to make sure I know what that means.
Oh, I love my man, Rick. But Rick, what I love about this, right? And you stated it explicitly and implicitly that industry provides our strategy around design. And you just, I say that to everybody. I'm like, we have to know what is going on in the economy. And then now we look at how we can apply these design principles in alignment to what we're seeing in the economic demand. I love it. You talked about programming, flexibility and scheduling, being strategic with industry partners, creating parent awareness about these options. And then something that I hope will become ubiquitous within time is that AI is not independent, you know, vertical, where now it's just standardized and a part of the common language within education. And I want to be able to now kind of go into that, right, where AI becomes a common language or the core language, as you stated. And that's where distinctively is arrival AI versus adoption AI. Arrival AI is that disruptor where now it just becomes naturalized within the learning organization and within the variables of the operating model. But how should leaders, Dr. Fernandez, you've been doing this, advising companies, advising founders, advising superintendents, chief academic officers, all up and down the continuum. But how should leaders take a systems approach with design so it purposely and intentionally utilizes this arrival AI method of now the core language is AI in every system, every operational node, and instructional strategy, framework, strategic operating plan of that learning organization?
Yeah, that's critical to build a system that can function, right? And you know this as a superintendent. The first part of that is getting your stakeholders and in your community and your school board not only on board, but really, really educated as to why it even matters. You know, I spend a lot of time with boards talking about the future of work, right? And it's not my, you know, yes, it is also my opinion and my belief, but I don't, you know, couch it as that. It's more about, here are the facts. Here is what industry is telling us that is coming. and level setting with, look, we can, I get it, right? I've got three kids of my own. I vacillate between like screen time and how much tech versus get your butt outside and play. And while we wrestle with all that, like the fact of the matter is that the skills that they need, if we abstain from tech, if we abstain from AI, if we abstain from things that they're going to absolutely have when they get into the workforce, is that's one of the best interests for kids. And so I think you got to present the facts of, if our goal is to, at the very base level, when kids leave us, I used to say this as a high school principal, and they, you know, what's your vision? Like, I don't know anything about that. When kids leave my high school, I need them to have options, right? I need them to have options. And that option could be a bunch of different things, but they've got to have some viability for whatever they want to do. So at the baseline level, it's like you want kids to be employable and be good citizens and have an opportunity to go live the American dream. And how do you do that if we abstain from tech, right? So kind of building that case of what's going to be our belief system for the community and the school district and the school board and everybody that's going to be impacted by anything that we do instructionally or programmatically or systematically in regards to AI. Once you kind of have that consensus, and then you've got to know your people and you've got to understand, with anything, there's always going to be a percentage of early adopters, a percentage of people that will resist change until, you know, the world ends. And then the big piece in the middle that you've got to get them up to speed. The great thing about, in my opinion, about artificial intelligence is this is not a curriculum. It's not something that is a new training. It's more of, they're using it in their daily lives, right? Even the people that are resisting, they're using it on their phone. They're using it when they shop. They're using it in their cars now that they probably don't recognize. So there's enough usability that's currently happening in people's day-to-day lives that we shouldn't have the amount of, you know, learning curve to a degree or adoption phobia to a degree, because they're already using it. Now, how we construct the system with the guardrails of all of the data security, what tools are we going to hold sacred? Now, that's the process that you've got to go through and decide, you know, with your teams of like, what are we going to, there's 30 million tools. What are the tools that we're going to leverage? How do we leverage them, and to what effect for our students? And that's just the staff, right? Most districts haven't really gotten into what does this mean for our kids, because the staff are struggling a little bit with like, where do we fit in all this? But then when you get to the student level, that's a whole nother set of questions, because your student level questions are, okay, if the students have access to virtually any answer for anything, do the answers matter anymore? Because we've always asked the students, like, what's the answer? Like, show your work, show the answer, SAT, ACT, provide the answer. So now we probably need to be thinking, well, it's not the answer. We've got to help them understand and get to the right question in the most efficient way, which, if we're really looking to build problem solving skills, I think that would be a great lead in, because constructing the right questions, you call them prompts, call them whatever, but that's going to be critical in their ability to compete. Because if you all have cell phones and you can all get the same answer, well then, okay, how do I take this thing that I need to create, this problem, and start asking the questions to build out my action plan to solve, right? Because that's kind of how people are using it to a degree. You know, just the everyday person is like, I ask a bunch of questions, get it kind of close. Maybe I can create something with it. Now I can make a presentation with it. That's kind of that baseline use. And our students will be doing the same thing, are doing the same thing, right? But that question, right? That scientific method, what a great way to inject that into our students. But we've got to solve for the adults first. And then we've got to really look at, all right, what does this mean for instruction? Are they cheating? Or are they doing what we all do in the adult world? It's like, I don't know. Let me go find somebody that does know. You got that system is going to be very complicated, because it's a lot of change and it's a lot of things that we've never had to touch. But I'll let your business community drive the why, right? Let your foundation be about, we want outcomes for students. We want options for students. Our business community, our national and global community is telling us, these are the options. These are the skills that are needed. If you want your child to be employable and successful, they probably need to be doing something in this realm. And that is the base. And I don't know how people can really argue, unless they don't believe in, you know, like, oh, this is just a fad, or you know, like people tell me all the time, I was like, well, you really think robots? I was like, yes. Yes, by the end of this year, like Tesla is ramping up now for mass production of their Optimus robot. Like you're thinking 2035, 2040? No, that's before 2030. Will you have robots in car rider lines? And that's crazy to think about. Or you'll have kids being dropped off in autonomous vehicles where the kid's just sitting there in the passenger seat and you open the door for car rider line. You're like, hey man, well, like that's coming. Like,
absolutely.
So what do we do with it, you know?
Absolutely. Rick, I always say this. We can't keep kicking the can down the road. That's essentially, you know, what we're doing. I want to highlight something when you talk about the future of work and how students are using some type of intelligent system in their life. In Generation Alpha, your kid's age, my son's age, 86% of them are using artificial intelligence 5 times or more during the day. That's at the bare minimum, 5 times, 86%. So if we think about that, Generation Alpha, and I love your quote, let the business community drive the why. This is where now we have to have this why of the necessary that we need to be able to look at the model differently, to be able to look at education differently, specifically undergirded by that statement, the future of work. I loved how you talk about problem solving with AI, and that is one of the indicators within my 22nd century systems learner framework, where now is not just in this analogous sense of problem solving, but how do we now teach kids to problem solve with AI, right? And again, you know, I always like to, you know, I challenge, you know, leaders, I challenge executive level leaders, right? Because we have this perseveration, we like to talk about different tools. But before we even get to the tools, we have to be able to align the various intelligent systems to the actual variables in our operating model. And to put that in simplistic language for my audience, we have to know what type of AI systems that we want in our classrooms or at the central office level before we even get to identifying what the tools are in alignment to our strategy. That is why I created the intelligent systems landscape, and I identify 6 different intelligent systems that can be aligned to the education model. Well stated, and I love this. Business community is driving the why, and this whole cheating aspect of it, Stanford University, you know, has a good study out there that shows that kids aren't cheating more than they were in the BC of education. So that question, are kids cheating? No, I think we need to build their capabilities on how to be able to now use it in their natural life. But Dr. Fernandez, I'm only going to limit you to 3 words to this. 3 words. And I'm probably not going to be successful, but I'm going to try it anyway. What 3 words, Dr. Fernandez, do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regarding Generation Alpha and Generation Beta readiness for an AC 2035 economy that is going to be heavy laden with this phrase that you stated, the future of work?
Curiosity, consistency, and entrepreneurship.
Oh, you're a rule follower. Oh, you're that mic drop. That's it.
That's it.
Oh man. He's like, I'm not elaborating. It's only 3.
I mean, that's what you gotta have. You gotta have those, like, if you can, if you know, I guess I could have said self-directed, right? Because self-directed learning is going to be critical, you know?
Absolutely.
So, you know, and one of the things, I do want to make this point because this is critical. The service that you provide is absolutely a massive blind spot, because even identifying within a school district of what are the things that we don't know we need to be looking for, mm-hmm. to inform how we do our work, right? And if we don't even know that this variable should be a part of how we look at instruction, then we'll never get on track. And so having a resource that can say, look, you've got all your student data, you've got your teacher data, you've got the things that we all kind of look at in this system. Here are the things that you probably should be funneling in, and here's the why, and here's the system to help you do that. So now I've just enhanced your ability to forecast, to maneuver, to adapt. And there's not a lot of people out there that can provide that type of guidance. And to the district's, you know, detriment, don't even know they should be asking those types of questions to come in and help. And why we agree, like, you got to have a data science on staff. Or if you don't, you better go find somebody like yourself that can help navigate. Like, you've got to start funneling in these things and building the regularity of how you analyze it to inform all this other stuff that you hold sacred.
Absolutely. And Dr. Fernandez, that was the rationale why I developed the Agile Diagnostic and AI platform and the work that's, you know, taken off in Texas that we're launching very soon. I would say within the next 25 to 30 days, because you're right. Some of the questions are latent questions that are hidden that needs to be asked that gets to that level of root cause or that root cause analysis. The platform, you know, one of the things is to really connect analytics to this rapid innovation, experimentation, rapid continuous improvement cycles that you talked about. But it goes back to leading learning organizations to the three words you were talking about: curiosity, consistency, and then this level of entrepreneurship, where we have to be entrepreneurial in our practices. Dr. Rick Fernandez, thank you for coming on Voices for Excellence. You know, I'm sure you know your fan base. I'm going to call it your fan base because you got a big fan base out there. Anybody that wants to become a part of the Dr. Rick Fernandez fan base, how would they be able to get in contact with you?
Oh, you can find me on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way. And I pride myself on being responsive and have a lot of great conversations. So look me up on LinkedIn. You can check us out on the Boys of EdTech with my four other partners. We do a lot in the education space. And so that's pretty easy to find as well. And if you're in Texas, you probably seen me somewhere. So I'm here to help. Everybody's here to help. And we want to make sure that our kids are successful. That's what all of this is about. A lot of challenges, but there's a lot of opportunity. There's so much opportunity out there for educators and for our system. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, Dr. Fernandez. Is that the Boys of EdTech sweatshirt? Listen.
We got merch. We had to. Yeah. Oh, yeah. My kids are giving me such a hard time. Like, Dad, you think you're like a YouTuber? Like, no, I'm not a YouTuber. This is for work. You know, I've never been hazed so much by my children for having a podcast, but man, it has been highly, highly informative to see like that entrepreneurial spirit, right? Like, I've got four other partners that have been doing this work that are all entrepreneurial that see some of these things and like, dude, it has been awesome. But engaging with those types of people that normally may not come, you know, as a superintendent, you're so insulated with the education community. Well, like your world outside of that is critical to help you, you know, decide what we need to be doing for kids, because this is where how life is happening when they get out, right? So
shout out to the Boys of EdTech. And you know, though, you know, all four of them, you know, when you think of how they spell boys, I remember when I was talking to Jacob and you guys were starting it and you had the boys spelled B-O-Y-Z. I'm like, wait, they boys in the hood?
Yeah, well, I mean, look,
Ryan,
that was
Jacob,
like
boys in the hood.
We were just we had to have some name. So I threw that out there. I was like, look, we'll just call it this until we figure out what to name the show. And then that just stuck. So
it has to stick, like Jacob is the dodo. So, but on that note, man, Dr. Fernandez, thank you for coming on. I'm sure I'll talk to you probably this week or later, you know, early next week, but thank you for coming on VFE.
Yep. My pleasure.
And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.